This is the Medicast, October 26th, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody here to the show. This is episode 190. We're creeping up on episode 200, probably going to come around Christmas time or just after the new year, sometime in that time frame, which will be right around the four-year anniversary here at the Medicast. It's been great to run through all those things. We've had a lot of great things happen here on the show, and I'm looking forward to many more years here, bringing the Medicast to you every single week. And remember, you can find the Medicast in your inbox if you're subscribing via iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. That'll be there ready for your MP3 player, your device, when you get up on Monday morning. I usually upload the shows sometime Sunday night, and the page goes live then, but that means it's ready for you to go right there Monday morning, and you should set your schedule by it. The Medicast will be there, and it'll be something for you to look forward to on that Monday. Don't forget, you can find links to the show notes and everything else that we talk about in this and every other episode at medicast.com/blog. That's the place where we have all of the entries, a lot of other great articles being posted all the time by Leanne and Steve over at the Medicast. Their two interns are really working hard to get some additional articles posted and a lot going on. So you want to make sure you check in there quite often. If you want to reach me here at the Medicast, don't forget you can send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is the way you get a hold of us here. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter. You can find me as under Podmedic at Twitter. You can also find the Medicast fan page. There's a link right off the Medicast blog. And you can also go ahead and find me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic as well. Speaking of Twitter, I actually heard in from many listeners this week wondering what's going on next week at the EMS Expo. Now, actually, it's this week. I guess when you guys are listening to this, I've recorded this a few days early, but we are going to be down at the EMS Expo myself. I'm going to have somebody there to help me out with the camera work. I also am going to be working with Chris Montera and Greg Fries from over at the EMS Garage and EMS Educast podcast. And we are going to be recording our shows and working together live the whole week of the expo. That's going to be Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday morning. We'll be recording episodes. We'll be talking with each other about the products, the people we've met and talked to, the trends and new things being talked about at the expo. And if you're going to be there, we want you to come by and visit us there at the expo. You'll find information about where we are right there in the expo program. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic, or look for the hashtag EMS Expo and look at what we're saying about the expo there. And you can also find more updates over at emsexpolive.com, where we will all be posting throughout the course of the week about what we're up to and some videos. We'll be recording live videos and then uploading them directly from the expo after we get everything edited. Maybe an hour or two lag time between when a show is recorded there and when it shows up on the EMS Expo Live site. But you'll be able to follow all of that directly. So if you can't make it to the expo, you'll definitely be able to see what we're talking about and catch the live videos that we've recorded. So it's all going to be a lot of fun. And I urge you to follow us and keep track of what's going on this week. And definitely, if you're going to be in Atlanta for the expo on any of the 3 days the exhibit hall is open, please come by and visit us. We want to meet as many listeners as possible. I'm bringing down t-shirts, water bottles, other stuff from the Medicast store to give away. So catch up with me. If you see me walking by, grab my arm and say, "Hey, Jamie, what you got for me?" And hopefully I won't have given it all away, but at least I can give you a shake of the hand and find out a little bit about you. So I look forward to that opportunity coming up this week. I also got a great email in from listener Greg. Greg's been checking in pretty regularly from Australia. He's a first aid services coordinator in the Northern District of New South Wales, Australia. And, you know, Greg, thank you for everything you're sending. Keep that stuff coming. And I found a link that he sent me with a unique take on CPR public awareness education. And I just will have to say, I'm going to send you the link in the show notes for this episode, and I urge you to check it out and see for yourself. I posted an article earlier this week on the Medicast blog about it too. But you know, it's a short 3-minute song music video that is pretty funny, and it also talks through the basic steps of CPR. Starting with checking for responsiveness and moving right on through the process. And the song is set at a tempo so that you can do compressions at the proper rate, if you can think about that song. It's something we've talked about, but we certainly need to do more about getting public awareness increased regarding bystander CPR, regarding how to do proper CPR, getting CPR trained. And I'm encouraged by the fact that this type of video is being produced. And I've gotten permission to share some of the video with you guys, and I'm going to make some video segments of my own here and post them up on the Medicast blog, and you'll be able to see a little bit about what I'm talking about and then follow up on it yourself. So anyway, that's coming up this coming week, and you'll see some more of those soon. I also got an email in from listener Sean. Sean checking in to ask a question about maybe we could do something about hypothermia, therapeutic hypothermia, as it applies to cardiac arrest patients, survivability of severe injuries. And so we need to look at this some more. We're going to be talking with some of the people down at the expo, and I might be able to put together something based on what they talk about, and maybe even set up an interview with somebody down there to bring some more information out on this topic and find some additional resources. So I'll be looking forward to doing that this week. And Sean, thank you for the great question. Again, follow up with me, and all of you should definitely do so by checking in here at the Medicast, over at emsexpolive.com, and via the Twitter feed, because I'm going to be updating a lot of things, and I don't know what I'm going to run into down there, but I will be looking for stuff on this particular topic, as well as a bunch of other things, and hopefully I'll be able to get a lot of your questions answered just by getting out there and interviewing the correct people there at the expo. It's a great opportunity to do that, and I'm looking forward to taking advantage of it. Our good friend Jerry Barrett checked in from Australia as well. Seems like it's Australian week here on the Medicast, but it's always good to hear from all of you. And Jerry checked in just asking some questions about recent episodes he'd heard and about links in those episodes. And I, you know, as always, direct Jerry and the rest of you to the show notes pages. If you go to medicast.com/blog, and right there in the upper left-hand section of the menu bar right there in the webpage, you'll see a link that says show notes. Takes you to all of the podcast show notes for every episode. This is episode 190, so you've got 190 podcast show notes there to check out. And you can slide back. There's about 10 per page. You can slide all the way back into the past episodes and find the one that you're looking for. And it's a great way for you to follow up on what's been going on in the show. Another way you can do that is to sign up for the newsletter. Every single week, I send out a newsletter when the show is released. Again, first thing Monday morning, and it's available for you in your email box. So if you're listening to the show and you say, oh, wow, I wish I knew how to get a hold of that information, or I want to look at this article he's talking about, you can do that by just going to your email, clicking on a link right there in the show notes. So I urge you to do that and follow up that way as well. It's a great way to keep in touch with what's going on here. I don't spam your inbox, but I do send out occasional other emails regarding things that are going on here at the Medicast, special opportunities and offers that are available for those of you that are students or are looking for things from the Medicast store. But again, I do respect your privacy. Doesn't get shared with anybody else, and I really try to make sure that I'm only providing you information that's valuable through that medium. So check it out, and you can find a link to sign up for that newsletter right there on the Medicast blog or over at medicast.com right there on the front page. Let's jump on into this week's news, and we're going to start off with a story about the helicopter crash that occurred in North Carolina about about a week or a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and some more information has surfaced on it over at emsresponder.com, talking about the fact that the helicopter was actually diverting due to weather concerns and problems nearby. They were trying to land at a nearby airport, but were unable to make it to the airport safely. And this is you know, an ongoing tragedy that we see this many helicopter crashes. Last year was a particularly bad year, but it doesn't seem like it's let up a whole lot. And we certainly want to think about the families and colleagues of the three individuals on that flight: pilot Patrick Walters, flight nurse Diana Connor, and flight medic Randolph Dove, all of North Carolina. So what we'd like to do, though, is think about when we use helicopter and aeromedical services. Some places are able to call up aeromedical transport easier than others, and it's incumbent upon any of us in the ground transport arena to really consider a couple of things about our patients. What is the most appropriate facility? What's the best way to get them there? And what other risk factors are associated with transporting patients, or for the responders associated with transporting those patients in certain conditions? And, you know, it's tough, but we need to make sure that scene safety applies to all aspects of the scene. And that includes from when you roll out the door on the way all the way back until you're parking at the end of the call. And scene safety should not go away until you're safely back in station. So it's something to consider, and transport considerations are going to be adjusted. The National Transportation Safety Board has already made some decisions regarding aeromedical transport use and regulations for how those organizations are monitored, types of equipment that are going to be required to be on certain helicopters or certain types of aeromedical transport. And I expect that this is going to be something that will be scrutinized more heavily as the number of these crashes continues to increase. It is a profitable business for hospitals to run these helicopter services. Don't let anybody tell you that they're doing it out of the kindness of their heart when it's hospital-based helicopter services like this. They're providing a service, but they're also billing in most cases for those services, or they're using those helicopter transports as a way of getting patients into their hospital that are having major injuries or major problems like MIs, needing bypass surgery, needing other major medical interventions that also cost a huge amount of money. All of that ends up adding up and can be figured into the overall profitability of the way they got there, the helicopter transport. As we move into the next story, it looks at immunity and first responders regarding things like Good Samaritan laws. Are we immune to being sued or being liable for certain actions conducted in the back of our ambulances? In the state of Missouri, this is being considered by a court at this time regarding a situation where a man died, and according to the report, and the paramedic involved inserted an ET tube into the patient to ventilate them. And at some point or during the course of transport or during insertion, that ET tube ended up in the esophagus and they never had adequate ventilations. This has been a big hot button issue. Should EMT paramedics and medics be allowed to intubate in the field? And one of the things that is constantly pushed out there is the fact that we so often have discovered esophageal intubation upon arrival at the hospital. This is something that is a big hot button issue with me. One of the reasons is, you know, if there are really that many esophageal intubations going on, you know, how are these paramedics checking for breath sounds? How are these paramedics verifying tube placement? Most of us, at least in my area, everybody has to have an inline capnography device to measure gas exchange during CPR. We can see when that tube becomes dislodged. You don't get gas exchange in the stomach. We see that process going on. We listen for breath sounds. And as I have seen in my practice and talk with other paramedics who have seen the same thing, Often, we find that the ET tube is dislodged when the patient is moved from our gurney over to the hospital bed in the emergency department. That process is a major move, and so this is a big issue. That's what this guy is being sued for in Missouri. Now, the court has, at least initially, and it's called a judgment of first impression. You can read the article to find out more about it. But they have initially said that EMTs should get the same type of immunity that is afforded to the police officers in that state. That because of the emergency situation, poor working conditions, you know, you're in a moving ambulance, this isn't a well-lit operating room, there are things going on, you're making assessments without full diagnostic equipment. All of these things make the job that much harder, and immunity protects you from making a snap judgment decision within your scope of practice. That's important. It's an important part of any negligence law. You did something that was reasonable. You made a reasonable attempt to get the job done, and you went in there and got your process initiated, whether it was right or wrong, should you be allowed to be sued. And so they've made an initial judgment that this is something that should be protected under immunity. It's important, though, for all of you, when you intubate a patient, to regularly verify tube placement, to regularly check, is the tube where it was at the teeth? You know, you judge the markings at the lip, at the tooth line, and you make a note of that. You check and see if it's still where it's supposed to be as far as insertion depth. You're listening to lung sounds bilaterally and listening for absence over the epigastrium. You're using an inline capnography device or at least a colorimetric device that's changing color with the presence of CO2 and measuring gas exchange. And you get to the ER and you've got this patient, before you move that patient off of your stretcher and you verify breath sounds again, have a nurse or a doctor verify breath sounds before that patient gets moved to the hospital bed. Why? Because I'm convinced, I don't have any studies to back this up, but every time you move that patient, every time you move the head, that is an opportunity for that tube to become dislodged. So you should be checking and following up on this. Ask for verification of tube placement as soon as you walk through the door, and then you can say, doctor or nurse or respiratory therapist verified tube placement upon arrival. Then, if that tube is dislodged and goes into the esophagus, you have someone else who verified your placement of the tube. Just another backup, another way to check yourself. And I hope that this never happens to you. But again, good documentation and good technique and consistent practices will protect you in many, many cases. Speaking of consistent training and application of that training, I want to wrap up our news today with a great story that comes out of St. Petersburg, Florida. This is a situation where a fire department lieutenant there in St. Petersburg, Joel Granada, was responding to a report of an infant choking and arrived to find a woman and a 7-month-old daughter choking on something. The infant was turning blue. Instantly, he did what he was supposed to do. He turned that infant over and began applying a back blows to that patient. And when he did so, a little black bow popped out of the patient's mouth. A little 7-month-old kicked that bow out. And, you know, this is a basic skill. You know, we talk about things like intubation. We talk about IV medications. We talk about all the things that paramedics and advanced providers do. But we cannot forget and should applaud those who understand that basic application of some of our most simple techniques are often all we need to use to save the day. And so I want to applaud Lieutenant Granada for doing his job the way he learned to do it. And, you know, this is the first time he ever had to do a choking victim with an infant and use those skills, but it worked just like he expected it to. And I think that this is something that occurs to me frequently when I teach CPR classes, is I wonder how often these people are ever going to have to use this skill. If I'm teaching providers, it's going to happen more frequently. If I teach the public, maybe never. But certainly, I want to make sure that they're learning good technique. And for those of you out there that are providers in the field or are learning to be providers in the field, make sure you keep in mind that your BLS skills are so very important. You can have all the advanced skills in the world. but you can't do anything for a cardiac arrest patient if you can't do good quality CPR to start things off. And that is the lesson that I take from this, that it is the basic skills that are ultimately there to save the day in so many cases. Yes, paramedics have an important role to fill, but it is the basic skills applied in a timely fashion that are going to make all of the difference in the world, and certainly made a difference for this young mother and her baby. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week, and we are joined again this week by our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. This week she's talking about toxic gases. Let's head on into that segment we recorded a few weeks ago here at Medicast Studios. This is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's time again for another Tox Tidbits segment with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Lisa, how are you today?
Fine, thanks, Jamie. How are you?
Oh, we're doing just fine. I'm looking forward to what you have for us this week because it's been a while since we've talked, but I know you've got a couple of good topics coming up in the next few months.
That's right. I think that these topics will be interesting to your listeners. It's a variety of topics touching on a variety of different things that we're seeing at the Poison Center. The first one this month I'd like to go over are toxic gases. Now, most of the poisonings that are reported to poison centers are ingestions, but we also get some exposures that are dermal exposures or eye exposures, and then occasionally we do get calls about the inhalation of certain types of gases. So I thought I'd review some of the toxicity of these gases. Now, the gases are broken down into several different groups depending on how toxic they are and what types of toxicity you see. And the first group are what we call simple asphyxiants. Now, these are gases that really are not toxic in the true sense of the word, but they displace oxygen from air in enclosed spaces like a room, and that leads to hypoxia. You know, you're just not breathing in enough oxygen, enough air. Gases that are simple asphyxiants include methane, which is natural gas, butane, helium, and propane. And then there's also carbon dioxide, which is dry ice, and nitrogen. Now, both of those gases do have some physiologic effects, but most of the poisonings with those gases produce hypoxic effects just like the other simple asphyxiants. Now, when somebody breathes too much of this gas in, or basically it's not so much they're breathing too much of the gas but not enough oxygen, they develop certain symptoms like an increase in respiratory rate, their heart rate goes up, they have decreased visual acuity, their mental status is altered, and then that's all followed by hyperventilation or almost like an air hunger type of response, confusion, numbness, and memory loss. They can become cyanotic, they can lose consciousness, and they can also have seizures. Treatment for these exposures consists of basically just removing the patient from that enclosed space so that they can get some air. And in some cases, 100% oxygen with assisted ventilation and other supportive care is needed. Another group of gases are what we call pulmonary irritants. Now, these gases affect the mucosa in the respiratory tract. People who inhale these types of gases usually develop symptoms within seconds, especially with pulmonary irritants that are considered very or highly water-soluble gases, and that would include gases like ammonia, sulfur dioxide, and chloramine. And in case you don't know, chloramine is actually the gas that's produced when ammonia is mixed with bleach. And we get a lot of people who do that. They want to make a better cleaner by mixing the two together, and then chloramine is released from that mixture. Patients usually complain of eye irritation, nose irritation, mouth and throat irritation, and they'll be coughing a lot too. Gases that are less water-soluble, like chlorine and another gas called phosgene, will produce only mild symptoms at first in some cases, but they're more likely to affect the lower airway. Now, calls to poison centers involving chlorine gas are usually from people who work with chemicals at swimming pools or people who mix bleach with a strong acid in a product like a toilet bowl cleaner. Phosgene is a gas that's used or released in the manufacturing of chemicals and products such as insecticides and a whole variety of different chemicals. It has an odor of freshly cut hay or grass that's pretty noticeable. When inhaled, it reacts with water in the lungs and it actually produces hydrochloric acid, so you can imagine how irritating that might be. you will sometimes get delayed effects like bronchitis, bronchospasm, and acute lung injury with any of the pulmonary irritant gases, but especially with those that aren't very water-soluble like chlorine and phosgene. Now, there's another group of gases that produce systemic toxicity. And some examples of those gases would be carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide, and hydrogen sulfide. They all act by decreasing either the delivery of or the utilization of oxygen. Carbon monoxide, as most of your listeners know, is a leading cause of poisoning, morbidity, and mortality in the United States. There are more than 2,000 non-fire-related fatalities and more than 5,000 fire-related mortalities or fatalities that are related to carbon monoxide inhalations each year. Carbon monoxide works by binding hemoglobin in the blood, and it produces something called carboxyhemoglobin, and that combination there makes the hemoglobin unable to carry oxygen to tissues. So the first symptoms that you notice following a carbon monoxide exposure, headache, dizziness, and nausea. And patients are often and can easily be misdiagnosed as having the flu. If the exposure continues or if it's a pretty high concentration of carbon monoxide, they'll also develop blurred vision. They may become pretty lethargic. They may have an increase in their respiratory rate. They develop a metabolic acidosis, and they can also have arrhythmias. People who die from carbon monoxide exposures usually die due to ventricular arrhythmias and cardiac arrest. Now, carbon monoxide also has a more of a direct toxic effect, and so it can also cause some delayed neurologic effects. People will develop dementia, psychosis, and even amnesia, and they can develop anywhere from about 2 to 40 days after the exposure. Treatment of carbon monoxide exposures is 100% oxygen, and also hyperbaric oxygen is used for those with severe symptoms, those who are at risk for delayed neurologic effects. And also, we have a pretty low threshold for hyperbaric oxygen therapy in pregnant women. The fetus has an increased risk due to carbon monoxide than even the mother does. Another gas is hydrogen cyanide. Hydrogen cyanide is generated in closed space fires, and we now know that it's a major contributing factor in smoke inhalation deaths, not just carbon monoxide. Usually there's a combination of the two. The cyanide inhibits cellular respiration. It actually binds to an enzyme that's called cytochrome oxidase. Symptoms usually occur really rapidly, often within seconds, and patients will become weak, maybe confused, their respiratory rate increases, they have bradycardia, hypertension, seizures, and coma, and then that's followed by a slowing of respiratory rate, hypotension, and tachycardia. Now, when patients are in the hospital, it's really difficult to get blood cyanide levels. It takes a while. It's usually a send out for most hospitals. And so the diagnosis of the cyanide poisoning is usually made when lab results show that the patient has a metabolic acidosis and an increase in lactic acid levels. Treatment consists of 100% oxygen, and there are various antidotes that can be given. Now, for years, we've given a three-step cyanide antidote kit that consists of amyl nitrite, sodium nitrite, and sodium thiosulfate. And those chemicals, those three antidotes, actually bind cyanide and then ultimately convert it to a non-toxic compound. Now, the problem is when the nitrites are given in the presence of carbon monoxide poisoning, such as in a smoke inhalation case, the oxygen-carrying capacity of hemoglobin is reduced even more, so it can actually make things worse for that patient. So fortunately now there's another antidote that's called hydroxocobalamin. The brand name is CyanoKit, and that's safe to use in smoke inhalation patients. It converts cyanide to cyanocobalamin, and that actually is another name for vitamin B12. So it converts cyanide to a vitamin, and that vitamin is non-toxic. Now, another gas is hydrogen sulfide. It's a highly toxic gas. It's released from degrading protein waste such as manure and sewage. It's also a byproduct in petroleum and natural gas industries as well as some other industries. It inhibits the same enzyme as hydrogen cyanide does, and so it also causes cellular hypoxia. It does have, because it's a sulfur-containing compound, it has a characteristic rotten egg odor. But with high concentrations, you really lose that ability to smell that rotten egg odor pretty quickly. You just don't smell it at all at that point. Symptoms that patients get are nausea, vomiting, confusion, changes in their heart rate and blood pressure can really go up or down either way, and dysrhythmias. And victims will collapse suddenly. It has what's called a knockdown effect in high concentrations with respiratory paralysis and seizures. Unlike cyanide or hydrogen cyanide, if a patient's removed promptly from the area, complete recovery might occur. However, in some cases, other types of therapy might be needed, such as 100% oxygen and antidotal therapy with sodium nitrite, maybe hyperbaric oxygen. And actually, we're unsure about this, but there might be some use for hydroxycobalamin with hydrogen sulfide exposures. We just don't know. There's not enough known about it yet in those situations. EMS providers should be aware that recently we've heard about some suicides across the United States and even here in Maryland from hydrogen sulfide inhalation when products containing sulfur are mixed with products that contain strong acids. That releases hydrogen sulfide. And most people have been doing this in an enclosed area like a car. First responders should be on the lookout for product containers that might indicate that that's what's being done. There might be this rotten egg odor. And also coins either on the patient or around the patient might look very dark from the reaction to that gas. With all toxic gas exposures and healthcare providers, EMS providers, you really need to take all precautions necessary to protect yourself from the gases. That's extremely important, particularly with a gas exposure. And always call the National Poison Control Center number for advice for gas exposures. And that number is 1-800-222-1222.
Wow, Lisa, that's a fact-packed segment there, and a lot of information, but a lot of great information and some things I really wasn't aware of. Does this have anything to do with the accumulation of gases that we see in farm silos? I know there was a recent episode in Pennsylvania nearby where there was a death in a silo. Is that similar? Is that any of these gases responsible for that, or is that?
Yeah, it's actually a different gas that's formed in the silos. There's various other things that can happen with filling silos, but there is another gas that's formed in that case. It's a little bit different in toxicity, but certainly the symptoms would be very similar to what you see with some of these gases like the hydrogen cyanide and whatnot, and it can also have a pretty rapid onset of effect in people who are in those areas.
Great. Well, Lisa, thank you for sharing this information, and we'll look forward to what you have for us next month.
Thanks, Jamie.
As always, I want to thank Lisa for joining me and providing this excellent information. And if you want to find out more, I urge you to head over and sign up for their newsletter at Maryland Poison Center, and that's mdpoison.com, and sign up for the newsletter. The email newsletter goes out to everybody. You don't have to be in the state of Maryland or even in the United States, but Lisa provides excellent resources. And the best thing about it is it's actually an email notification tells you to go back to their site, and you get a nice one-page PDF download that you can post in your station. It makes a great training tool, and it's something that can be read very quickly just while you're just kind of standing right in front of it. It's a quick and easy read with good information aimed directly at you, the medical professional. So I urge you to head over and check out more information available from Lisa's website at the Maryland Poison Center, mdpoison.com. Well, it seems like it's time for me to wrap up the show here, and I will get closed out, but I want to remind all of you to check out the links in the show notes, the news articles. There's information in there about some of the toxic gases that Lisa talked about and the link to the Maryland Poison Center, all available for you directly in the show notes for this episode. So please follow up on that information and make sure you take advantage of that tool either in the show notes or if you sign up for the email newsletter when those links get sent directly to you every single week. Don't forget to get back in touch with me if you have any comments or suggestions, links, or anything else. Check in with me here at the Cast voicemail line. You can call into the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Put that in your cell phone. Keep it in there. And when you hear me say something that's got you like yelling at the MP3 player, heck, call me up and tell me what you got on your mind. This is a two-way conversation as much as possible, folks. I don't want to just sit here and talk to my computer. I am here talking to each and every one of you, and I count each of you as a friend and a colleague, and I want to hear back from you about what you like about the show, what you don't like, and again, support the show by giving us your comments and suggestions, news links, whatever else you have for me. And so definitely do that. You can also reach me by email, podmedic@mac.com, or again, you can even contact me via Twitter under the handle Podmedic or over at Facebook as well. All of these are great ways to catch up with us here at the Medicast. Also, don't forget to keep up with me and get in touch with me if you're going down to the EMS Expo this coming week. Or if you're not, definitely head over and check out the videos. We're going to be interviewing people on Man on the Street interviews, talking to attendees. We're going to be looking at innovative new products. We're going to be recording episodes of the shows down there. And you can actually, if you can't get down to the EMS Expo site, the next best thing is going to be following us over at emsexpolive.com. We're going to have all the videos posted over there within a few hours of recording them. So you're going to really get a good sense of what's going on at the Expo site from looking at our short videos, watching our live podcast recordings. And yeah, you're going to see the podcast that'll be showing up next week's Sunday night episode. You can actually watch me record it live right there at the Expo. Well, at least live to tape. So who knows what'll happen. We might have people walking by or whatever, but at least it'll be fun. And I want to see as many of you as possible down there. I'm bringing some stuff to give away. So definitely come by our little stage there near the Cygnus booth. We're going to have a place set up to meet you there, have stuff to give away, and we're going to have microphones set up to have questions from you come into the show. So it's a great opportunity to talk directly to us, your favorite EMS podcasters. And Greg Fries, Chris Montero, myself are all just so excited to see all of you down there. Time to close out the show. I will end up with some PodSafe music like I always do. This is a song from a good friend of the show. We've listened to her songs for a long time here at the Medicast. And this is her song, I'm Not Responsible. This is, of course, the very lovely and the very talented Laura Clapp. So if you like what you hear, check out her music. There's a link in the show notes and in the newsletter you'll be getting that will send you directly over to iTunes. If you'd like to spend 99 cents, buy one of her songs, let her know that way. You know, spending a dollar lets her know that we liked her songs and you'd like to hear more of them here on shows like the Medicast. So check out those links and let these artists know that we appreciate them sharing their great music with us. In the meantime, I'm going to be heading down to the Expo. I'm going to be driving safely and maintaining good vigilance for scene safety and BSI. But of course, I have to remind all of you the same thing. So I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, perhaps when we meet coming up this week at the Expo, don't forget, folks, scene safety and BSI.
But you wrap your guilt around me when you don't get your way. And you bleed all this blame. Clean your cut, wrap it up, take care of your own pain. Cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Why can't you let it go? Oh, yeah. Cause all that you're crying about happened 2 years ago or more. You hit rock bottom, now you're pacing its floor. But what I'm talking about, it's climbing now, well no one's help but your own. Cause it's you, not me, is gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible. Grow some backbone, stand up for yourself. 'Cause I ain't taking no more, and neither is no one else. Oh, 'cause it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not so sorry. So it's you, not me, who's gonna set you free. And I'm sorry, but I don't have the time. And it's me, not you, that ends up feeling used. And I'm sorry, baby, but I'm not. I'm so sorry. Oh, oh, I'm so sorry, baby, but I'm not. Sorry, so sorry, baby, but I'm not. Sorry, baby, but I'm not responsible.